state your full name and your date of birth.
My full name is Jackie L. Jensen.
And
I was born September the 30th, 1924.
And you were born where?
Torrance, California.
And
it's just an outskirt of L.A. It's grown into L.A. now.
Well, what made your family, and what year did they come to LeGrand?
We didn't actually come to LeGrand first. We moved to Payette, Idaho. Uh-huh. My dad's brother, Agner, had just purchased a brickyard in Payette. And my dad was more adapted repairing machinery and getting things going like this than his brother Agner was. And so he went into partnership with my dad. And so we moved to Payette, Idaho in 1937. Mm-hmm. And that was quite an undertaking. There were five of us children, me and four others, and we saw snow for the first time. There's no snow in Southern California.
Yeah. Well, then what made your dad decide to come to LeGrand?
Well, we found the remnants of the old Towery brickyard here, and the brickyard in Payette was going pretty good at that time, so Dad and I decided, well, we'll buy this and put something together and make brick. This is about the time I got out of the service in 46?
The war was over in 1945.
Uh-huh. I guess it was about 45. Uh-huh. And we moved everything to LeGrand, and Bill, you mentioned Watson. Watson was that front end loader I made. And the reason it was called Watson was because most of it was made from a World War II surplus vehicle. It was a landing craft. It was actually a boat and truck combination. And it was quite a large machine. And evidently, the chief operator of this vehicle was named Watson. It was written on the dashboard, and it was very plain to see that this was run by only Watson.
So the name stuck.
And so this name stuck with the remnants of what we used to make Watson. And I think most of the kids in LeGrand know that tractor by that name. John Combs lived here about this time. He moved back east, and here 2 years ago he came back. He is now retired. He's like a 60-some-year-old man rather than a 15-year-old boy. But his first, the first thing he wanted to see was good old Watson. He went out and shot up about 100 pictures of that thing. Well, it is still here.
To start the brickyard, what all equipment did you have to get ready so that you could make brick?
Everything. There was nothing to make brick with. And so we had to run on our intuition and what knowledge we had of brickyards. Brickyarding has been in the Jensen family for five generations. Up to me, I'm the fifth generation that has been a brickyard operator. My son Chris and Greg and Dan were the sixth generation, and they did work for a little bit. So we've been in kind of thing. But anyway, we put in the semblance of a machine that would extrude clay, and we had an old 1895 cutter. It looks like a butter cutter or an egg cutter, It's a big heavy machine that draws wire down through the clay column and cuts this bar that's being extruded out of the machine into 2 1/4 inch width. And that was about all there was to the first machine that we operated for the first year. We shoveled the mud into the machine, took the brick as they come out from the cutter, put them on pallets, and that was our first year.
The pallet was a wooden platform, and you put how many brick to a pallet?
A pallet contains about 85.
85.
And the bricks are, because they're extruded, they're quite stiff, and they will support quite a bit of weight without deforming.
Now, your mixture for to make a brick, the mixture, you got the clay from this site.
Yes.
At the brickyard.
Most brickyards, clear back to ancient times, they would take a clay, which is an aluminum silicate, and aluminum oxide. It's mostly aluminum and oxygen. And they would mix it up until it would form kind of a stiff patty. And then they would let it dry and watch the shrinkage that would take place until it was just air dried. And everyone tries for an 8 to 10% shrink. If it's too rich, it'll shrink more than that and crack. And if it shrinks less than that, then there isn't enough clay to give it strength. And so we try for about 8 to 10% shrinkage. Mm-hmm. And what we temper it with is just sand. Mm-hmm. Sand or even dirt will work. Sometimes they would just use dirt, but mostly it's just sand and clay mixed. We had to use two parts of sand to three parts of clay to get that shrinkage down. This clay here is very rich.
Your sand, you usually got out at Sand Ridge out there by Hot Lake?
Yes, we got sand. We got sand out there and different places in the valley. The valley has quite a bit of sand deposits here and there. Be interesting to know how it got.
Well, now, when you put the brick on the pallets and dried them, about what was your loss between cracking and a possible rainstorm?
Depending upon how well we kept them covered when they were very wet, and how hard the wind blows because everything was dried outside, we would probably get 5-10%.
Now, in making the brick, you made a common brick, and then you made one with a scratched surface. What was that called?
A facing brick. A common brick is generally a mixture of everything, and it's used for for instance, insides of fireplaces, insides of furnaces and whatnot, places where they wouldn't generally show.
Doesn't have any design on it or anything.
No,
but
a face brick could actually be scratched with a bunch of nails in a row.
Or when it was being
it could be sheared off, and it left kind of a rough surface.
And this occurred when it was being extruded from this mixing machine.
Yeah.
That made it come out in a square form.
That's it. Otherwise, it would be a little hard to do after they were burned.
You also made pavers.
Yes. A paver was actually the brick column. The brick column as it came out was approximately 4 inches high and a little over 8 inches long. That is the bar that is coming mm-hmm. out of the die. And if we wanted to make pavers, we would mount a steel cutting wire crosswise, horizontally crosswise, on the die as the clay come out, it would cut itself in two. So there'd be an upper and a lower piece. And now when it goes to the cutter, two out of every three wires were eliminated, and now the cutter would actually cut an 8x8 approximately square, and there'd be a square paper on the top and one on the bottom.
Now when your brick and pavers and what have you have been air dried, you went about putting it in a kiln. Could you explain what a kiln is?
A kiln is just an oven, but it's an oven that you could compare to a ceramic kiln, because the temperatures inside the kiln are going to end up in the neighborhood of maybe 1600, 1700, or 1800 degrees Fahrenheit. And the reason that clay is brought up to that point is that at that temperature there are there is enough glass in the clay so that this low melting point glass will slightly melt and fuse the particles together, and it makes the brick extremely hard. The chemistry involved is aluminum silicate, which is clay, aluminum silicate. It's aluminum and silicon and oxygen. And on this molecule, there is a hydrate or a water molecule attached. And this water molecule is attached to all clay that we would find naturally in the ground. And this water molecule also camouflages the color. It gives the clay a brown appearance. Now, if we take that water or that hydrate molecule and detach it from the aluminum silicate, now the reflective color of clay, if it has other elements in it like iron, will turn red, green, yellow, or whatever. So it's important, and it becomes a solid. It won't dissolve in water anymore.
Well, now when you started the kiln, I know that there was a series of arcs in there as you made the brick so that you could fire the tunnels. And would you explain that?
Firing clayware, whether ceramic or heavy clayware like bricks or tile, is very demanding on the temperatures that you raise to begin with. Air-dried clay that looks just dry actually still has lots of water in it. Now, some of it is mechanical water, which means that if you just heat it up, it'll evaporate. Some of it is a chemical water, which is the chemistry of water that's actually water molecules attached in different ways to make different compounds. And so in all firing processes of brick, tile, clay, whatever, involves a slow heating process. And we bring the first heating temperature is about 312. And we hold it until we can measure the humidity of the exhaust that's coming out of the kiln. And as soon as the humidity goes down, then we can raise it to the next step, and that's about 700 degrees. Between 700 and 800 degrees, we have a process the water chemistry, the chemical water, breaks down, and there's a sudden evolution of steam or water that comes out. After the chemical water is extracted, you have one more stop that you have to make before you turn it on full, and that is the oxidation of the carbons that are in the clay. Most clays have a small amount of carbon, and the oxidation of the carbon would convert it to carbon dioxide. And so we hold it at approximately 1200 degrees to get this carbon oxidation state. Now if we would take what looks like a dry brick and put it into a 1700 degree kiln, which is the final temperature, the brick would literally explode like a piece of dynamite. And it's very important that this doesn't happen. It's very expensive to rebuild the kiln. which we did one time, and I don't know if you remember it or not, because I think it was something that we did. I had turned a little kiln. It could hold two bricks in that little shed downstairs, and I thought I would just raise the temperature very fast. So I was going to come upstairs and do something. I forgot. I turned it clear up to 1700. And I came back. I don't know what I did, but I think it was something we did, huh? Up at your house, I came home and I see this white powder all over the downstairs ground. And I look in there and there is shredded ends of, it was an electric kiln, and there is powder and pieces of brick sticking to the walls all over that shed. And that was the result of.
Well, what I am wondering about, the number of arches that you put in a kiln and the size you usually made it. When we were firing with slack coal.
Uh-huh.
We had the long kiln there, uh-huh. And how many portholes were there?
We could have 3 brick lengthwise between arches.
Uh-huh.
Arches with the fire.
And you stack the brick before it's being fired in those arches.
Yes, with spaces in between, uh-huh. So the heat can pass up to them. That was the skull kiln. That's the one you.
Uh-huh.
I see.
About what size was that? I mean, in feet.
Held, the scope kill we had held 100,000 bricks.
Uh-huh.
And scope kills, that's the way they're built. The scope kill was quite the common brick burning furnace way back in history. The last one we had down here was a little tunnel kiln, and that it worked backwards of a scope kiln. The fire is inside an arch kiln, and the fire comes in one side, up the top of the dome, down through the bricks, through holes in the floor, and the exhaust gases are led away through an underground tunnel to a chimney outside the kiln. The Skov kill was the
Skov kill from the beginning when we started the first fire until we brought it completely up into heat and then let it cool. About how long did that take?
The burning process would take about 6 to 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that time was used in water smoking, which is this gradual buildup. The actual burning of the brick took place in about the last 2 days, and so that went very fast.
And later, then when you started using propane for the first time, you started using the tunnel kiln.
Yes.
And then you also used waste motor oil, as I recall.
So we would use some waste motor oil. It was the one way of getting eliminating waste oil from the city. It made it a little harder to operate, and most of the oil was diesel,
mm-hmm.
diesel or a bunker, a thinner bunker oil, and that worked quite well. We never really followed through with propane. Propane is a little on the expensive side,
mm-hmm.
and coal or natural gas would probably be the most economical fuel to burn with today. There are so many restrictions nowadays, so that on anything that you burn, that a lot of the businesses have gone out. They can't.
Well, I remember you were one of the first to use propane to operate your reel truck.
Yes. Yeah, we converted the reel to propane, the main power plant to propane, and so it was quite a change. There was a lot of people that came out to see what the process was.
Okay, we were talking about the propane and the reel truck and your other engine. And what was the advantages of using propane?
Well, propane is, when you use propane, you use it as a vapor, not a liquid like gasoline. Gasoline in an engine is sprayed to get it to vaporize as fast as you can. And it's almost impossible to get it to completely vaporize before it passes through the engine. And consequently, as those droplets, they are burning in the presence of the oxygen in the engine. And by the time they pass through the entire engine, why, the gasoline, which is a hydrocarbon, has lost most of its hydrogens, and is now just carbon left, and it leaves a little chunk of black stuff that comes out your tailpipe. And that's the common way of explaining the gasoline. With propane, it's entirely a vapor, and it's as good as completely burned before it gets to the engine. And there is no carbon particle. And so we found that our oil filters, we changed the oil filters in our car because we felt guilty rather than the oil getting black.
What can you tell me about the brickyard before you came here? Do you know the history of it, Jack?
The brickyard has been in a couple of locations here on the place. It was located out back for a while. Later on, it was moved to about a couple hundred feet from where it is now, from the back. When it was in the back...
We're close to the Ordell location.
Yes. It was quite an active place. They had 20 or 30 people evidently working out there. And when it moved the first time to the second place that it existed, a man by the name of Ed Towery had it. And this was still a brick process. They call a soft mud process because the bricks, the clay was mixed with water to a soft consistency and either slammed by hand or pushed into a sand-coated wooden mold to get the shape of brick. And the molds were turned over and the brick dumped out, which is strictly a muscular process. The extrusion process didn't come out until about 1900. And we have one of the very first extrusion process extruders down there. That's what we ran with.
That's similar to a toothpaste tube and pushing the toothpaste out, and if you were to cut it off, you'd cut it off into pieces.
I explain it to the school kids. We generally would have school kids, children that would come out every year. And most of the school children know what a meat grinder is, because quite a few homes still have meat grinders. Well, the extruder, the clay extruder, looks like a meat grinder, that rather than just being 3 or so inches in diameter, is now approximately 30 inches in diameter. It's huge machine. It takes a lot of horsepower to do it. And the inside is just kind of like the auger in a meat grinder. And as the clay is dumped into the back part of this extruder, it's this screw inside pushes the clay forward with tremendous pressure, and it exits through just a small water or oil lubricated die that keeps the edges, the tops and the bottoms very smooth and shiny rather than ruffling. But as you say, it comes out just like toothpaste on a tube. And it, for all the world, looks like fudge. It looks like candy. And I've had twice in my lifetime here on the brickyard watch one of the school kids convince himself that it was edible and take a bite. At that point, the boys in both cases, they got out of there quick because they had a mouthful of sand and grit. It's very hard to lecture to a bunch of school kids and watch a scene like this, and this made it a little more difficult. But I think probably a lot of what promoted this was we had another factory across the tracks from us, the sausage, what was that?
Valley Sausage.
Valley Sausage. And the kids had just visited Valley Sausage just before they came to the brickyard, and all of them had gotten a little hunk of sausage to eat. Well, this is an edible trip. There's been a lot of very fun experiences in my life because of this. I've enjoyed talking to the kids when they come down. There was one bad feature, though. All of them wanted a little piece to take up clay, you know, brick, to take home with them. And most of it was used to throw out the windows of the buses. And you could see where they had been when they arrived at school.
Your brickyard operation was mostly done by your parents and your brothers and sisters when it started, and as you had your family, then your boys and girls helped make brick also. Is that correct?
That's right. We have hired people. We found that we had just about enough family members to operate the brickyard. So it has. It's been a family project. It hasn't been so big that we couldn't do most of the work just ourselves.
Then when you got the finished brick, you sold them to the local lumber yards and then out-of-town sources?
Yes. Locally, the city of LeGrand would use about 25%, maybe 30% of what the brick we made, and the other 70-75% was shipped out of town. We ship bricks Pendleton, Elgin, as far as Wallowa, Baker. We did have a few that would go to Portland, but not too often. But there wasn't really enough brick building going on to support a full-size brickyard. Most people were still using siding and wood.
You once told me that most of the brickwork was done in November and colder months.
They would end up, bricklayers would come from out of state, and they found that the winters here weren't California winters. And we would end up about November in a, what would you call it, a crescendo? A triple forte. And we found a lot of jobs that weren't completed, and so the old standby bricklayers that stayed here would have to go around and finish jobs all over the place. I found myself even going out and helping with some of these.
What year did you start laying brick yourself?
I started laying bricks when I was 14 years old.
Oh? So
by the time I was 18, I had probably laid a 500,000 bricks. But it was on the brickyard in Payette, and it wasn't anything that required.
Well, Grand, you build a lot of fireplaces.
I think some of the most... I started laying bricks rather early in life, and I started mostly laying bricks for people that their particular bricklayer had run off and left the work half done, and so I'd give them a helping hand. But what I was going to say is I think some of the most interesting jobs I run across is like working, putting a face on a building downtown, or perhaps the college. I did quite a bit of work at the college, putting pavers in where kids were walking. And I found that there were particular times a day when the traffic was pretty heavy, and so I had to plan for these particular times of day. And was it Ackerman?
Yes.
Ackerman. We had a teacher training a student class called Ackerman, where the student teachers of the Eastern Oregon College would practice, I guess you'd call it, with the students. And these students would get out of class about 30 minutes before their bus came. And of course they all headed for this kooky bricklayer that was putting pavers in their sidewalk. And within a few days, well, it ended up that I would have to plan on this, and as soon as the bell rung, I would have several hundred little kids sitting on the ground, and we had a class right out in the middle of the... And we had a full-scale class. They would raise their hand, ask questions, and we just had a good time. This went on and on, and one day, the school bus came, all the kids headed for the school bus, and I noticed there was about a dozen grown-ups sitting intermingled with the children. These were the school teachers, the college professors, that had such a curiosity to find out what was going on out there, that they had snuck out and infiltrated the troops. And they came out laughing and said, "By golly, this is really an interesting class we have out here." Downtown, it was altogether different. You always have to entertain when you're on Main Street. And if you're timid, you better not try something like this. There are people stopping and asking questions, and it's an all-day process of entertainment. I remember one day, two ladies had walked inside the staging, the scaffolding that I used to kind of shield myself, and they had walked right over to where I was putting some rock facing on the face of this apparel store. And I turned around to get a trowel full of mud, of mortar, and this lady was clear up to her ankle in warm mortar and didn't know it. I was faced with a terrible question of how to solve this problem. And I finally got the lady's attention. She looked down at me, and I politely said, "You're standing in my mortar." Poor lady almost died. So what can a bricklayer or a rock mason do? He politely lifted the lady's foot and scraped all the mortar off with his trowel. And I found myself washing a lady's foot with a bucket of warm water on Main Street, with about 50 people standing around and applauding. These are some of the things that can happen on Main Street.
When you, after you came to Le Grand, you married Jean Hendrickson, and you started building your house just above the brickyard. And the first part of the house was about 24 by 24, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, just a little square.
And as your family expanded to a total of 6 children, your house got a little bit bigger.
Yep, putting these add-ons, and upstairs and downstairs. And I have thought since then, I should have made it so I can take the add-ons off. But I find that when the kids come home for Thanksgiving, I still need more add-ons. So I'm still perplexed of what to do here.
Well, then, as kind of a sideline, you got into photography. How did you get into photography?
Let's see. I think there was. I have done photography all my life, but not commercially. I got acquainted with John Turner, my good friend John Turner. And we had a lot of fun just developing and printing very. All the photography that our family required. We got to the point to where we were taking pretty good pictures. And one day a lady called and said, "I can't get a photographer. Could you come down and take my pictures?" And I did. I tried to act as professional as I could, and it seemed to please her. And I made some good pictures, and from that day on, it was just one after another.
You took weddings,
family
portraits,
genealogy
pictures,
yeah.
For as you're a Mormon and belonged to the Mormon Church, there were quite a lot of that going on.
And I think John Turner did too. And we had quite a rapport with picture taking. John Turner and I have taken many, many pictures.
Reunions
and scholastic settings with football players and whatever. And it has been a fun time. I can think back of sometimes scary, wondering if we did the right thing, and we were very anxious to get home to process our film to see if there was anything there. But, yeah, that's been fun. Incidentally, with John Turner, we built a pair of almost identical houses at the same time, too. So we had a lot of in common.
That's true. We did. It's been a very good friendship, I understand. Well, actually, I can remember the day I walked down the street and I met you at the Episcopal Church, and you were taking a wedding. And you told me, he says, well, why don't you do this, John? I said, oh, I didn't want to do that. And we talked a little while, and we traded cameras that day.
Yeah.
I had a 4x5 camera, and you had a little Century.
Uh-huh. And really good.
After you had taken the wedding and everything, I went home and got my camera and swapped you.
Yeah.
We did a lot of work after that.
Oh, boy.
In the early days, you built a swimming pool here in your front yard.
Yeah.
We had taken a class reunion the night before, and I must have left here after developing pictures about 2-3 o'clock in the morning,
uh-huh.
And you poured your swimming pool after I left.
Oh, boy. They were sometimes pretty exciting. Did we remember to take the shield out of the holder? And we couldn't wait till morning, could we?
No, we had to get it done. Well, then, in order to sell our pictures, we had to have them the next day to sell to the class. So it made a difference whether we made money or we didn't.
That was it, yeah.
Have fun time, Jack.
Yeah. There's been a lot of them, hasn't there?
There has.
I remember one photographer in town, I forget what his name, maybe you remember him. One of the scariest periods of time in his life. He had a 4x5 with sheet film holders. And we have to load the sheet film holders with one sheet of film at a time and interleave between the film as we bought it was a black sheet of paper. And anyway, this photographer had loaded the very first number one sheet film holder and the black sheet of paper was still covering the negative when he put it in his holder. When he put that in his camera, the black sheet stayed in his camera and he took all of the pictures of the wedding without getting one picture.
Oh.
Just listening to him tell me this story took me several months to get over this, thinking, I wonder if I'm doing Can you imagine? Not one piece.
Very scary.
The next day, everybody from the wedding has gone back to Wyoming, New York, California. No wedding.
Well, then, when did you get interested in astronomy, Jack?
I've been interested in astronomy ever since I was like 12, 14 years old. I had my first telescope when I was 14. It was a little 3-inch telescope. My grandfather had bought it for me. And I built an observatory when I came to LeGrand. Very early. It was one of the first things I added on to my house here, was a little observatory. And it was a little closer to the house than where it is now. And this little observatory was inside a round building with a shiny dome on top. And it caught the eye of most of the teachers, and almost immediately the school started asking if they could send classes up. And so they would send a class up for an astronomical field trip. And I've been doing it ever since. I've had probably between 3,000 and 4,000 school kids up for an astronomy class in field astronomy since that time. About 60, we moved the observatory to where it is now. Mm-hmm. And what we did was first pour a half round cement dome for a downstairs underground planetarium, and then we put the telescope, the observatory, on top of that. So when the kids would come up for a session in astronomy, the first half hour or so was in the planetarium, where we could see all the stars with the planetarium projector inside this domed enclosure that was underground. And by this time, it was dark enough to see stars, and so now we would go out and find the interesting thing between the stars. And, it's been so much fun. I've had so much feedback on kids that I've got parents that have gone through the observatory that have brought their children back. Last year I had a family from Alaska. They made a special trip down here with their family, 3 kids, just to see the observatory that he saw when he was in Riveria School over here when he was a kid.
Well, you ground one of your own your early lenses. Can you tell me how you went about that? How
the grinding process with the optics on a telescope is extremely precise. You first start with a blank piece of Pyrex. If your lens is going to be, we'll say, 8 inches in diameter, the Pyrex is approximately 1.5 inches thick. And you have to have the blank that is going to be the lens and a tool which is almost identical to the lens itself. They're both round discs, approximately the same size. And actually what it amounts to, in a crude way of showing, would be to sprinkle some water and some very fine grinding grit between these two discs. And the top disc is held with you in your hand and passed back and forth over the bottom disc. And as you do that, the top disc, which is your lens, actually starts to round, and the bottom disc will become a convex. The lens itself becomes concave because it actually grinds a slight hole for a, it's called a sagitta in optics, in the top one. You keep that up until you get a curvature on that lens approximately what you want. And that that curvature is rated as an F number, which is a focal length of this lens. As soon as you get the rough ground, then you start doing the same process, passing it back and forth, but you use finer and finer and finer grit until you end up with rouge, which is actually iron oxide. And the rouge has the capability of literally flattening the surface. The rouge, the last stage of smoothing, because you're not grinding anymore, it's called smoothing, is done with a very, very fine grained grade of ruse that literally trowels the finished surface. It doesn't grind. You're working on an atomic basis, and these little tiny flats or molecules of iron oxide actually, as they're pushed back and forth under pressure on this glass, they heat the glass up just briefly and push it down, just like you were troweling cement with a trowel. So it's a very, very, very interesting process. It's a process that ends up dealing with parts of a millionth of an inch of deviation on the glass. And so the big lens on the observatory out here now is about 13 inches in diameter, and the curvature on the face of the lens has to be accurate to within approximately 1/10 of a millionth of an inch. Otherwise, it won't work.
Do you put it in kind of a tube then? How do you mount it so then the lens will work and you can view?
Okay, there are two types of telescopes. There is a telescope that you look through the lenses, and this type is called an achromat. An achromat, you literally look through the lenses like you would in a camera. And then there's a reflector. With a reflector, the bottom, the lens itself, actually reflects light rather than passing light through it. So this structure that we just talked about is just a superstructure for a very, very thin layer of metal, generally aluminum. And this glass now is aluminized in quite a complicated process. And this, we tried to put approximately 200 to 400 molecules thick. Now that is not very thick. You can see through it. 200 to 400 molecules is deep, is just the right amount to keep from building little aluminum mountains. So if you go over that, then you start to distort your image. So they tried to put just a thin layer on that. Now, if you would picture this reflector at the bottom end of a telescope, the light comes through at the top end. It passes through the telescope. It is reflected from the mirror, which is concave, or this slight dip in the middle, and comes to a focus someplace up inside the tube. At that, just before it comes to a focus, we put a diagonal mirror so that the light can be reflected out through a hole in the side of the telescope tube itself and through an eyepiece, which finishes the focusing for the human eye to see through. A telescope eyepiece is slightly different from a daylight binocular. Eyepiece for a telescope is actually made to use only at night. There is a part of the eyepiece called an exit pupil. And the exit pupil is actually a diameter of light that comes through the eyepiece, and nighttime vision is a black, or the pupil opening of your eye opens up to about 7 millimeters. In the daytime, the pupil squinches down to about 4 millimeters. And so a binocular that you would use in the daytime, the exit pupil is a 4 millimeter exit. a telescope eye to the 7mm thing. That's some of the technical stuff that a lot of people will understand.
Well, we'd have to know, because there would be a number of people that won't know how you arrive at doing that.
Yeah. There's some mathematics involved, and they're not complicated. And most anybody can do it if they have the patience. But it takes a lot of patience in optics.
Have you found anything interesting in space out there?
I don't think anyone will stop looking for new things in space. It's we keep finding out more and more as we look farther and farther into space. We find that that astronomy is actually a collection of mathematics, as far as we can go in mathematics. It has to do with history. The things that we see in space is past history. We mean past history. Things that have happened millions and billions of years ago. It includes, there are many religious beliefs and on the face of the earth, and most, I would say, all of them incorporate astronomy in some part of their religious belief. It has to do with chemistry, every facet of science that we can possibly think of, things that we can't do on Earth is being done in space. And that's why we keep looking.
Well, it's a good explanation. Now, there was a time that you worked for the state of Oregon in affecting the weed burners for the farmers. Could you tell us a little bit about that and what you did?
Yes. The farming in Oregon about 30 years ago had reached just about a peak in the process of growing grass seed. And Oregon was noted all over the world for the high quality of grass seed. And but the problem with raising grass seed is that it becomes infected with all types of diseases and weeds and stuff. And they found that if the field was burned quickly after the harvest, that the ground was sanitized by fire. It not only killed the weed seeds that were on top of the ground, but the fungus and all types of biological stuff that was really bad for the plants themselves. So they asked the people, or the people that would try, to build a machine that would burn the grass without producing this volume of smoke that open field burning was producing. And so I went to Eugene and built a field burning machine. I learned a lot about this. The smoke that open field burning would produce was very toxic to a lot of people. It was also quite harmful, because the process of that they were using to burn the field would send huge volumes of burning grass into the air, as the fire from a peripheral burn would produce. And these big armfuls of firebrands would go way up, and then they would land on the neighbor's haystack, and somebody wasn't too happy. And so this was a problem. So I went to Eugene, and I...
That's Eugene, Oregon.
Eugene, Oregon. And built the first machine. And what this amounted to was an enclosure that was completely enclosed, that would move slowly along the ground. And very quickly, that is, we had to burn completely, we had to burn the loading of grass straw on the ground. At high temperature, we could only exist for, I think, 3 seconds. If the fire was extremely hot for more than 3 seconds, we would kill the grass. So this little nodule just under the surface could be exposed to this terrific heat for not more than 3 seconds, and then cold air blown on it. And this was quite a process that we went through. We had we would use the grass straw as the fuel. There would be no fuel other than just the grass straw involved, but it would be burned very quickly. And they found a phenomena that they hadn't discovered before. And that is, if this tiny nodule, which is where the life for the germ, you might call it, of the grass was sitting, just under the surface, if it was exposed to heat for not more than 3 seconds, then the next year it seemed that this was a stimulus that would produce up to 25% more seed the next year. So you not only got a good sanitizing effect from the fire, but you'd also produce a better crop. The only problem is these machines were slow. They weren't quick like an open steel burning. And then they were much more expensive than open steel burning. And the farmers didn't want to agree right off the bat, because they knew that once the machine was developed and accepted by the Oregon Steel Burning Commission, that they couldn't open steel burn anymore. And so they kept stalling and stalling and stalling. Meanwhile, the steel burning committee kept cutting down on the acreage it could be open steel burn, and it became quite a tangled up mess. So